ね。Okay, fire and fall back. Yes. Hey, that was a good article you wrote in the Army magazine, too, by the way.
Well, I wanted to talk about something else. Are we really free now to disagree with you?
Sure.
Well, I do have some disagreement.
All right.
And I'd like to start off by saying I feel kind of like the piss ant that somebody tried to kill with a sledgehammer. But despite that...
I notice that's a pretty strong piss ant, though, sitting there.
But I would like to... I really hadn't anticipated a kind of a direct attack on what we put a lot of work in.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish that attack all the success that I feel it deserves. But the behavioral science chair is trying to give the practitioner something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And if our mission, our goal, the purpose of being, the reason we get paid, if it's leadership, I think we're remiss if we don't look at any tool that can help us.
Mm-hmm.
In the execution of leadership, whether it's scientific, practical or historical, past, present, or whatever it is, because
mm-hmm.
that's our business,
yes.
And that's our job. Now, the behavioral scientist got to work with models, and to him, I would draw an analogy. The model that he uses is kind of like the model that I would use as a long-range patrol leader to give you a map, and that map is a model. It's a model of terrain. It's a way of representing something we can't bring in to your CP and show you, but we can bring a model. And it has blocks and diagrams mm-hmm. and arrows saying mm-hmm. this equals that, and these little round circles here mean that the ground is higher. So that's the way
right.
that guy's trying to use that model. And it's a field of knowledge that is imperfect. We know that. But it's a field of knowledge that's trying to explore, trying to develop along with the growth of knowledge that's occurring throughout the world. We know about that.
Yeah.
We know that change is upon us. We know that the Army today is a hell of a lot different than the Army that was. That change is going at a rate that we're difficult, having
mm-hmm.
trouble keeping up with. We've got to cope with the change.
Yeah.
And basically, there's coping with change is kind of like getting up in an oak tree. There's two ways. You can climb the damn tree, or you can go sit on an acorn someplace. And it's true that as you climb the higher you climb, the more your tail hangs out, but at least when you get to the top, you can see the forest. And that's what the behavioral scientists are trying to help
right.
the commander to do. So it's a concept
right.
of balance.
Right.
And I
Well, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying, and I agree. And I probably overkill. By the same token, and I'll give you the other side of it, I have never disagreed with the need for behavioral science research. In fact, I've encouraged it. And my second son first wanted to go back to West Point and teach in the social science department, and then said to me, "Dad, I don't think so. I think I'd like to go back and take behavioral science. I'd like to get my master's degree in it and go back into the military leadership department." And I said, "I think that's great, son. I encourage you to do that. I think that's great." My other boy is studying history at Duke now, and he's going back and teach military history at West Point. But the younger boy, he wants to get into the behavioral sciences, and I encouraged him. So, if I gave the impression that I was against behavioral scientists and the study of leadership by behavioral scientists, I gave you the wrong impression. But what I will stick with is that I don't agree with you that you need to display your results and the kinds of models that you're using. And that if you're displaying your results in a model which turns off the recipients, then you'd better start climbing another trunk of that tree or another branch or look at some other way to get up that tree. Because I read Jack Heffling's articles in Army Magazine when he was a director of the leadership department here, And they turned me off. And I went around to my lieutenant colonels and majors and captains and asked them. And it turned them off. And you know it turns off the sergeants. So some way, the behavioral scientists have got to come up with their findings and get a better way to transmit their findings to the recipient so they can put it into practical application, rather than hard-headedly sticking to their model and diagram concept. I think there's other ways to get across leadership, is what I'm saying, than refining it into blocks and X's and squares and things. And that's where I thought the Army War College study went astray. Not that there wasn't a group of brilliant young men working on it. Not that they didn't come up with some good things. I didn't wipe out that whole study. But the format of it turned me off and turns off most people who are trying to understand leadership. That's my point. But you've got to study it. Of course you do. What the hell have I been doing in my own simple way? But reading Soldier by Ridgway, and reading Bradley, and reading Mark Clark, and reading Eisenhower and Crusade in Europe, and reading 19 Stars, and reading Dark December, and reading, Christ, I got libraries full of them. I'm trying to find out about how you lead, what do you do, what's right, what's wrong. What are the things that work, what don't work? I've literally, you don't get this stuff just because you happen to be a guy they happen to like and stuff. You work at it. And I've worked at it in my own clumsy way. I've just read and watched and listened and tried to learn. And if the study, the applied study by behavioral scientists can enlighten us faster, can open up greater avenues, can do it better for us, I encourage it. I'm all for it. But I think, again, they've got to look at the way they present it. And I don't think they can engage in what I call intellectual arrogance and say, well, if you want to learn, you've got to learn it the way we want to show it. I think the behavioral science has got to say, if we're going to teach it, we've got to figure out the best ways acceptable to the recipient and put it in that format. Okay? Yes.
Sir, Captain Harris of the Leadership Department here at the Infantry School. And I'd like to start off by saying that I'm just a captain and I probably shouldn't say anything.
Don't apologize. I wish I were.
But I've been in this business of teaching leadership for 2 years now, and I've worked a little with Colonel Malone, and I went to the Center for Creative Leadership, the outfit that you were talking about in North Carolina that helped General Emerson. And I've seen both sides of the behavioral science and there the way they train leadership and the way we train leadership. I was a company commander in Vietnam and a platoon leader. And my observation is that what the behavioral scientists teach, like Dr. Farr and the Center for Creative Leadership and Dr. Jacobs, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding by a lot of officers, senior and junior and everything, about what they are trying to say with their models. And at the Center for Creative Leadership, I found everything that Dr. Farr and Dr. Penner worked there also. The things they taught made real good sense to me in terms of my practical experience. And they were very practical men, yet they don't have the experience we have in terms of leading troops and all that. But what they teach and what Dr. Jacobs, in fact, Dr. Jacobs yesterday spent a couple hours telling us that it doesn't do us a lot of good to teach theory and models. He said that doesn't make sense to soldiers and NCOs and officers. We need to take their findings and put it in terms of practical cases and our practical experience. In other words, they can help us a great deal, but it's our job as leadership instructors to take those models that don't really make sense to anyone else but behavioral scientists, and things like Colonel Malone's War College study wasn't really meant to train leadership. It was meant to show the things that we need to do. We need to take that and put it in terms of practical leadership instructions, exercises, case studies, things that really involve the students. And my big criticism of Army leadership instruction is that we don't have the time to really teach the students to do what you just said. We all know what you just said is exactly right. But how do we teach students to do that? And I don't think we can do it in lectures. And we only have, say, 26 hours to teach leadership. And we have great content there, but we can't tell him what to do. We've got to put him in situations where he learns by experience what to do. And as Dr. Jacobs said yesterday, when a guy gets out on the job, he doesn't really get a lot of feedback. People won't really tell him what to do. And we need in our schools to put them in situations where they make mistakes, they make the bad judgments, and then we as instructors show them where they goofed up and where they learn it here in school. And I don't think we have the time that we need to do this in our leadership training.
All right. That's a good, valid remark. And I must say at the outset that I agree with you. It's always concerned me. I'm a product of the school system, you know. And I went to the short course at Leavenworth, and I went to the long course at Leavenworth, and I was on the faculty at Leavenworth 3 years. And I attended the Armed Forces Staff College, and I attended the National War College, and I attended the Harvard Advanced Management Program. So I've been subjected to a lot of courses. And it always disturbed me when I analyzed as a troop commander what I did all day and broke it out into time spent. Time spent on, say, personnel and leadership. Time spent on tactics, time spent on logistics, time spent on intelligence, you see. And I came up, as I analyzed all of my activities as a regimental or division commander, with a gross feeling that I spent about 85% of my waking hours on personnel and leadership, morale matters. And then I spent about 15% of my time on tactics, strategy, logistics, technical aspects of my leadership. That is, I went into the morning briefing and I heard it, you know, and I said, yes, no, right, we won't, you know. But most of the day, I was dealing with people, greeting new officers, saying goodbye to all officers, pinning awards on, talking to soldiers, asking them questions, going down to greet a new battalion arriving, saying goodbye to a battalion that was departing, reviewing court-martial cases, talking to my judge advocate general, going down to visit battalion commanders and talking to them, and mostly it wasn't too much about tactics or strategy, but just human relationships and interface. And I try to figure out, Christ, all my military career, I've been studying 85% of the time that which I do 15% of the time. And I've been doing 85% of the time that which I study 15% of the time. The whole thing seems screwed up to me. And I don't believe that our service schools spend enough time on leadership training. And don't call it leadership, it isn't all leadership training. It's morale, personnel, administration, the way you train, the interface you have with your people, the kind of problems you have, the administration of justice, the kind of things that you as a commander can do, the little gimmickry, the little tricks of the trade, the all of the stuff that's inherent in command. And all you do is learn that by on-the-job training. Then you go off to school and study like hell that which you do so seldom. Of course, it has to be right when you do it. But I agree that you have to take findings and place them in presentable form. And by the same token, I want to challenge the behavioral scientists to put it in more presentable form to begin with. Help make it easier for us to translate it into some way we can teach it. Next question, or statement, either one. Yes, back row.
Sir, Major General, one point to possibly reinforce your comments, sir, on the behavioral scientists. At Leavenworth, I had one briefing. I'll try and keep it real brief. But anyway, the behavioral scientists recognized that the Army of 1970 wasn't the same as 1941. Specifically, the man coming into the Army wasn't the same. Cultural impacts and everything else. The purpose of their study was to try and capitalize on this somewhat reinvention of the wheel and project into the future so we could anticipate what sort of man we would have in 1985 or 1990 time frame. All of this sounded very good, except the ultimate purpose of the behavioral scientist, and it seemed, I may be speaking out of turn as though they are working in a vacuum, was that they were losing sight of why we have an army or anybody else has an army. Wage war, specifically ground combat. And they were looking at this time frame of trying to figure out the type of individual we would have in the Army so as to how to make the Army compatible to this man. And it was my contention that we should make this study to try and determine what we are getting in order to determine what we would have to do with the raw material in 1985 so as to make him an efficient soldier, recognizing that he may come from a society that didn't lend itself to producing soldiers in either the traditional or practical sense. I just felt that there was a slight twist there based upon the fact that the people that were making the study were not really looking in terms of the final product they had to produce, a soldier, if you will, but were looking more in isolated or in a vacuum-type atmosphere and were really losing the main thrust of the whole exercise.
All right. Well, I think when you get in an academic environment, whether it be behavioral scientists or whether you're writing the field manual on airborne operations, which I once wrote, you have a tendency to become scholarly and grasp and grope and strain. Sometimes it gnats, but you're straining to reach some conclusions and to sort things out for yourself. I didn't want to have this whole thing wind up in a dialogue as to what the hell was right or what's wrong with behavioral scientists. I want you to start talking about leadership, so let's get with the program. Yes.
I guess I'm going to be the springbok. I think talking of leadership, sir, you hit a point, and 3 years instruction at Fort Sill just emphasized the point with me. Maybe one of the things we need to do in leadership is whatever leadership is, encourage people to read. My observation, one man's admittedly, was that very, very few people within the contemporary officer corps spend much time reading. There are very few people who know of Grant's campaigns, but everybody knows the Wall Street Journal and how the stocks are doing. I think your point is well emphasized by the fact that at this stage in history, militarily speaking, it would take a complete genius to come up with an original screw-up. They've just about all been done, and if you read about them, you can pretty much learn how to avoid them.
That's right. Of course, you do learn that. You learn big things. You know, I listened to Sir William Slim years ago speak at Leavenworth on the art of high command, and he wove a one-hour talk around the art of high command. He said it was just 3 points: no papers, no details, and no regrets. And he wove his whole talk on the art of high command, and I used that as a leverage point when I said, well, now I'll talk about the art of low command, decide, explain, and enforce. But there are all kinds of ways to do things. You know, some people are delegators, and some are perfectionists who find themselves incapable of delegating. And you have to really worry about a man like that. I worry about him. That's when you find the splendid young captain and tremendous major. You just think he is great. And all of a sudden, he gets to be a colonel, and he can't command that regiment, or he can't command that brigade. And you're disappointed. You're shocked. You thought he was better than that. You're wondering about your own judgment. You wonder, how did I misjudge this guy? Well, you didn't misjudge him. He was awfully good at those things he did himself. He was fantastic at those things he did himself. But he hadn't learned to use other people to help him. And he was such a perfectionist that sometimes when he used other people, And they didn't do it quite the way he would have done it, nor quite as well as he would have done it. He couldn't resist the urge to take over, not recognizing that 40 guys all working, each one doing not quite as well as you would have done one of those things, is doing so much more than you can possibly do alone, it's not even funny. So you've got to learn to trust people. You've got to learn to turn her loose. How does Coca-Cola run with all those little plants all over the world, all those managers? Who runs all those 7-Elevens? Who runs all those Sears Roebucks, you know? The guys at the top have got to be able to delegate. They've got to have some confidence. They've got to accept the fact that there'll be some stealing here and some lousy handling of materials there, that something will fall through the cracks. It won't quite go. But on one of your points of leadership, I must say to you that your comment reminded me that you've got to delegate. You cannot reach positions of high responsibility without being willing to lay your money on other people. You've got to lay your money on other people. I know I had a brilliant fellow with me on the faculty at Leavenworth, and he worked so hard, but what a pity. He even came back at night and cut his own stencils because he didn't like the work of the secretary that was assigned to our department. How ridiculous. This man bordered on genius in terms of intellectual capacity, wasting his time sitting there cutting stencils because he was such a perfectionist. Any other questions? You've got a man here. I don't want to infer anything wrong with this man because I loved him. He was my first battalion commander. You all know him. I talked to his own son about this just the other day. His son is a brigadier general. And that's old Henry Kelly, Harry Kelly. And they call him Machine Gun Kelly. And he's been with Humro for years. And he was a great, great instructor at Leavenworth. And he was director of instruction. He, as I say, was my first battalion commander. And that man didn't make general. And he was brilliant, and he was conscientious, and he worked hard all the time. He's over 70 years old now. He's working very, almost 80. He's still busy, and everybody says, why didn't he make general? And I think I can tell you why, because I go back to 1937, when I was a second lieutenant in G Company, and I was in charge of the pits in the range. And the 2.5-ton truck showed up in front of the supply room at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we were loading the targets and the paste and the markers and the rest for the rifles. I was going out with my detail as the young lieutenant in G Company to set up the range. And the rest of the company was coming out a couple of hours later. And who should show up down there? Captain Kelly, the battalion commander. Not only does he show up, but he's helping me load the truck. And he's telling me where he thinks the target should go, and if you get him in over there, Lieutenant. And I couldn't help but think, as a young lieutenant, what in the hell is the battalion commander doing down here now, and why won't he let me load this truck? So this is a point I'd like to get across. You've got to be willing to let other people work for you. And everybody needs a pat on the back, some high and some low. Yes.
Sir, Captain Lofton, leadership department here at the school. I'd like to take issue with one point that you made.
You're not Randy Lofton, are you?
Negative, sir.
Okay.
I'd like to take issue with one point that you made, and you have an obvious distaste for models and conceptual approaches to problem solving. Yet you, in your talk today, gave us one. Decide what you want to do, explain why, and enforce. Mm-hmm. This is nothing more than a model, a conceptual format, a process for getting results.
That's how true.
There seems to be a variance between what you say and what you practice.
Well, all I'm saying is we're not talking about what you do, it's how you do it. And all I'm saying is that most people, when they read books on leadership, don't like to wind up with diagrams, lines, charts, blocks, and deciding, explaining, and enforcing can be written rhetorically and don't have to be shown in a format. That's my only point. My point is that the physical placement of things in models as such has a tendency to turn off the recipient. It may not turn you off, but it turns me off, and it turns off a lot of people I know.
But it is an easy way to explain sometimes.
It isn't easy if nobody likes it. That's what disturbs me, that those people who believe in it are going to cram it down your goddamn throat whether you like it or not. And I'm telling you, people don't like it.
Thank you for a very stimulating hour, and it's been just great, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of discussion about this in the seminar and workshops to follow, and that's what we want.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Let's take a break till 11:22.